50 states. At the time of our visit, the median household income for the United States as a whole was a little over $50,000. It was about $37,000 for the state of Mississippi and closer to $30,000 for the region we were about to visit. The region was part of the so-called Black Prairie of Mississippi and Alabama, so named because of its rich soil type. The geological Black Prairie also coincides with the historical and sociological Black Belt of these two states. That designation refers to the area's high concentration of slave labor plantations before the Civil War and of African American population ever since then. One Mississippi portion of this Black Prairie has renamed itself the Golden Triangle. It is the area in east central Mississippi, along the border with Alabama, that includes the medium-sized cities of Columbus, Starkville, and West Point. It has become, improbably, a new industrial zone of the South. The three cities have different stories and situations. Starkville is the home of the leading research university in the area, Mississippi State, and has the greater stability and higher-end amenities that come with being a university town. West Point is the smallest of the three and, in recent years, has been the hardest hit by economic change. In 2007, Sara Lee closed a nearly century-old meat processing plant that had employed more than 1,000 workers, fully a tenth of the town's population. Since then, West Point's unemployment rate has been nearly 20%. Columbus was historically the richest of the cities, and it still has many mansions from the plantation era. But through the past generation, it had been hit by the one-after-another collapse of low-wage manufacturing jobs that had come there through the mid-20th century. It has relied very heavily on the nearby Columbus Air Force Base, which Mississippi's powerful congressional delegation has defended through wave after wave of base-closing measures. The whole area is poor.
Like the Greenville Governor's School for the Arts and Humanities, the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science, or MSMS, as it is fondly called, is a public two-year boarding school. It draws students from big towns like Hattiesburg and small ones in the impoverished Delta. MSMS was founded in 1987, shortly after the administration of educationally progressive Governor William Winter, who 5 years earlier had introduced sweeping reforms for the state, including mandating kindergarten for all students and compulsory school attendance until age 16. MSMS was the fourth such specialized secondary school for math and science to be established in the United States. Despite its veteran status, today MSMS remains modestly financed, primarily by state funds with some additional foundation and private support. The school occupies a number of plain buildings on the grounds of the elegant Mississippi University for Women, traditionally called the W. The men who have enrolled at the W since it became co-ed say they always have a time explaining themselves to those not in the know. Students come to MSMS to spend their last 2 years of high school in accelerated science, math, and computer courses, as well as in a deeply rich selection of arts and humanities classes. Few kids arrive with a portfolio of science genius, but they learn fast. While we were there, I saw a fascinating array of projects in progress. In one corner of the glassed-in entry to a main classroom building was a grandfather clock, probably about 8 feet tall, constructed by one of the students out of brightly colored plastic pieces. On the hour, a golf ball would roll down a chute, tripping levers to ring a small chime. Upstairs in one of the science rooms was a 3D printer, a rough-and-ready contraption that reminded me of a homemade boat. Within a few more weeks, it should actually be printing, said Donnelly Gunn, who'd made the 3D printer himself. A dozen or so students in the robotics class were testing the robots they had built for an upcoming national competition. There were three robot missions, search and rescue, a mock sumo wrestling match, and a bell lift, where the robot scooped up a bell and delivered it to a destination. The humanities classes at MSMS were described as the school's secret weapon by Wade Leonard, an alumnus who works at the school. Just spend a little time in Thomas Easterling's English class where, when I visited, They were reading a Bharati Mukherjee short story, and you get that. The students, busy being teenagers, were in high spirits. "Curb your enthusiasm," Easterling called out at one point. Most of the students were taking notes on laptops. One was multitasking his laptop work with a task on his phone. An Indian girl in the class was quietly correcting the pronunciations of the Indian names in the story. The pupils seemed fascinated by Mukherjee's life story, and, adolescents that they are, were comfortable and attentive in a discussion about self-discovery. Easterling drew them into talking about whether a person's immigrant status accelerated their self-discovery. "Abso-stinkin-lutely," was one hearty response that pretty much revealed the energy and engagement of the class. In Chuck Yarborough's U.S. history class, students researched the lives of individuals buried in the town's Friendship Cemetery. Columbus was a small town of about 6,000 people during the Civil War. Being near a rail line, Columbus received many Confederate casualties of war, which led to its becoming well-known as a hospital town. By the war's end, some 2,500 Confederate soldiers were thought to have been buried in the Friendship Cemetery, along with, according to the National Archives, 32 Union soldiers as well. Yarborough's students from the year-long Tales from the Crypt research and performance class choose an individual who died before 1930, locate his or her gravestone, then plumb the town's archives of Union and Confederate Civil War records, county court records, family files, and more at the local library, the county courthouse, and university collections. They learn how to conduct the very hands-on work with original documents. Archivist Mona Vance Alley at the Lowndes County Library, young, attractive, and modern like so many women I have met who work at public libraries across the country these past few years, took me into the archives vault. We drew out a file, and she walked me through the exercise the kids learn, donning gloves and carefully turning pages, trying to interpret what they find in the county register of slaves, court case transcripts, and secrets of the community, making real the racial history of their state. Yarborough's African American history class also stages a cemetery production called the 8th of May Emancipation Celebration. The students perform in-costume reenactments that they write themselves with music, based on characters from among those buried in the town's African American Sandfield Cemetery. As Yarborough describes it, students in both these projects must wrestle with the tangles of Mississippi's history to research and tell stories that reflect the racial, ethnic, gender, and spiritual diversity of our area. The performances are exercises in reconciliation for the students as well as for the residents of Columbus who attend. Yarborough emailed me with an update a few years after we saw a production for ourselves. A huge crowd, over 200 people, showed up at the cemetery. He wrote that the students were particularly engaged this year. It was a time of heightened racial troubles in the United States. Considering past periods of increased racial-ethnic cooperation in our story and how our communities might foster a return to those realities. Selling the school to Mississippi parents is hard. Even a school that regularly sends state championship teams to national science fairs and scoops up half the writing awards in the state, that turns out winners of Gates Millennium Scholarships, and in 2015 had one of its alumni chosen as the first African-American woman Rhodes Scholar from Mississippi. Several students told me that their moms were scared or nervous or didn't want them to leave home. And the students themselves mentioned the compromises they had to make, particularly abandoning extracurriculars that weren't available at MSMS. But those comments were invariably a warm-up to their feelings now. "I am so happy to be here. I have so many opportunities. I am so fortunate." At MSMS, it's not surprising to meet a student who grew up in a shack or a double-wide, and to find them being friends now with others who came from private schools and affluent families. The kids were all in it together at MSMS, and many talked about how it had opened their Mississippi eyes. An African-American girl from a nearby town even smaller than Columbus said that her hometown high school was 100% black, and she appreciated being in a diverse environment now. A white girl from a larger town in the south of the state said that her private school had been all white, and she echoed her friend's comment exactly, adding, "My roommate is from India. I had never met someone from India before." A black boy from Columbus said that his high school had been somewhat mixed, but it was really all about football. He said he appreciated being in a place where football didn't dominate everything. Many MSMS alumni have already reached their dreams of becoming doctors, aerospace engineers, veterinarians, academics. Gunn, the student who built his own 3D printer, was on his way to Harvey Mudd College. He said he would like to get cheap 3D printers to resource-deprived third-world countries, because such printers could help their dreamers make what they need to build the products they might imagine. And after that, he continued, he wants to return to Mississippi to build his own engineering company, which would also do its part to address the education problems in Mississippi. "I am very blessed. I'll never forget where I am from. I see the struggle," he said, also adding that it is about more than football.
The most modern-looking aspects of this part of Mississippi are centered around the Golden Triangle Regional Airport, built at an approximate center point of the Triangle's three towns and offering commercial airline connections to Atlanta. Just beyond it is a sprawling modern steel mill owned, at the time of our visit, by the Russian Severstal Company. It was later sold to an American firm. Nearby are large factories making truck engines, helicopters, drones, and other advanced devices, paying wages equal to several multiples of the local household income. Not far away, Yokohama Tire of Japan was building a major new plant, which opened about a year after our visit. In all, the Golden Triangle region had brought in some $6 billion in capital investment in the decade before our visit, creating about 6,000 new jobs in an area of concentrated poverty where this influx has made an enormous difference. Why so much? Why here? And to what effect? The answers go in every direction. The search for non-union labor that has drawn companies from the Northeast and Midwest to the South is a central factor. Incentives from the state and local governments are another. Plain old political log rolling has been crucial to Mississippi and some other southern states. Its representatives are tough on federal spending, and even tougher about keeping earmarked projects coming here. And on down the long list. But there are countless places that offer incentives and discourage unions and would love to have the factories. Each of the big employers that has recently chosen the Golden Triangle considered scores or hundreds of other possibilities, many in the South and some in Mexico or the Caribbean, before coming here. Why here? Allowing for all the other explanations, it still seemed clear that a handful of forceful people made the difference in shaping the region's economy as a whole. In a way, this is consistent with a pattern we were beginning to see around the country. A stalwart group is determined to give Eastport, Maine a chance. A series of civic leaders shifted the Greenville area of South Carolina to a new civic and economic footing. Successful business people who retained a strong local identity made a huge difference in the character of Holland, Michigan, and Sioux Falls, South Dakota. In this part of Mississippi, it's harder to identify purely civic leaders who have played a comparable role. But it's harder still to ignore the difference that the area's economic development team has made, including Joe Max Higgins and Brenda Lathan, and their colleagues at a regional organization called the Golden Triangle Development Link, and Raj Shonak of East Mississippi Community College. This was brought home in our first visit to the area. One day I was taking a tour of the major industries around the Golden Triangle Regional Airport with a group of investors from the Midwest who had put money into the region and were considering investing more. On the bus back to the airport, where several of their own jets were ready to fly them back home, one of the investors told me, "There are entire states that can't come close to what this team has done here," meaning Higgins and Lathan. Lathan is an imposing black woman who grew up in the area. Higgins is an imposing white man who is a relative newcomer. Together, they have led a transformation of a left-behind area of a famously left-behind state. During that visit, Deb and I sat with Higgins in his office and asked him to describe the sequence of development in the area. Higgins grew up in Arkansas as the son of a sheriff and cultivates a Southern sheriff bearing. We asked him what the turning point in the region's recovery was. He had a long list, but he focused on Eurocopter, the facility, part of Airbus, that makes helicopters for both civilian and U.S. military use. Eurocopter was really, really a big deal, he said. It was important because they make helicopters. In a county and a state where most people think the women are all barefoot and pregnant, all the men got snuff up in their lip, we're all members of the Klan, now we're making shit that flies. That genuinely changed our psyche. It was monumental. When Eurocopter came in, people started walking upright a little bit. It's a story he had told before, and he reveled in the barefoot and pregnant effect, and apologized pointedly to Deb a few times when he thought his language might offend her. But he was talking about something real. On his pickup truck, Joe Max Higgins has a vanity license plate that reads 2 EQ last. He explained it to us, using a joke he had clearly told before. In the economic development business, coming in second equals coming in last. You get the deal or you don't, and there's no reward for a near miss or giving it a good try. It's a subtler version of the standard signature line in his email messages. Live every second as if your ass is on fire. You expect talk like this from any number of football coaches, and Higgins's talk about his region's prospects is very much that of a coach. One example was his description of how he ended up in this part of Mississippi. It started with a recruitment call in the early 2000s, a dozen years before we met. When the headhunter called, he told us, and said, "I want you to look at a position in Mississippi," I said, "You gotta be kidding me. I hear Mississippi and I hear poverty, despair, no future, no hope for a future." Then we drove through here. The azaleas were in bloom. It was pretty. My wife said we should at least look the place over. We looked at what God gave them and what they were doing with it. I said, "There's no reason in the world these folks aren't winning." But they're not. Within "they're not" was the whole range of local economic woes, from a starting point of low income and high unemployment to a recent wave of factory closures among the low-tech, low-wage small firms that had moved to the South from the Depression era onward. Higgins went back to the headhunter. I said, "Here's what I want. Audited financial statements, budgets, all this kind of stuff. I spent weeks just looking at it. I came to the conclusion these guys should be hitting home runs, but they're not even getting to the plate. That's an opportunity." So he signed on and has gone at full speed ever since. On what had happened since then, Higgins showed us a very detailed chart of all the industries that had included the Golden Triangle in their site selection during his time there, the number that went ahead, what that meant in terms of capital investment and tax revenues, and what it meant in jobs. If you take it strictly on investment, deals we've won versus deals we've lost, we're batting 442, he said. And some of those deals we lost are ones we said, "Go away, we're not interested." But now, in jobs, we're batting 241. So how good are we, really? 241 is maybe better than most, but it won't get you into the Hall of Fame, not unless you can play second base like a champ. But 442 will get you into the Hall. And then Higgins continued on to an argument about why the average had to go up. Everything about Joe Max Higgins's talk, walk, body language, and comportment is go, go, go. Do, do, do. A profile of him by William Browning in the Columbus-based Catfish Alley magazine pointed out that Higgins, who is burly by anyone's standards, used to go through 2 6-packs of Diet Coke per day. By the time we met, he had backed down to just eating packs of an energy powder called Spark. The Golden Triangle's first big win was its certification as a TVA megasite in the mid-2000s. The megasite system was a way for the TVA to speed investment within its region by pre-clearing certain sites as being project ready. They had the infrastructure, they had the permits, they had enough contiguous land, they had everything else. As a Federal Reserve report described them, the Tennessee Valley Authority coined the term in 2004 for sites in the TVA region that could be deemed worthy of large-scale development, 1,000 acres in size, environmentally clean, and accessible to transportation and utilities, among other criteria. A Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis assessment a few years later was positive. Megasites spur big turnaround for Mississippi region. Higgins and his colleagues at the Golden Triangle Development Link wholeheartedly threw themselves into the competition to be awarded megasite status. Higgins told us, "The TVA was tired of every bean field, cotton field, corn field in any town USA saying, 'We're going to have the next Toyota, Nissan, Mercedes plant.'" So he and his colleagues hired a prominent national consultant to design the criteria for certification. "Everybody showed up," he said. "The could-bes, the wannabes, the never-wers, the thought-they-wers, they all showed up." All the candidate regions were asked to provide simulations of how they would handle major new investment and to supply specs on every economic, infrastructure, labor market, and environmental consequence of economic growth. "They had a 2-foot-high book of specs," Higgins said. "We worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, optioning the sites, doing the soil borings, everything." To cut to the conclusion, in August 2004, the TVA certified its first 2 megasites. One was Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and the other was near the Golden Triangle Airport in Columbus. "The worm turned then," Higgins told me. "That TVA decision was the inciting incident that changed this community forever. I'm serious. Before that, I'm working little projects. I'm working a sweet potato plant here and a small, small automotive plant there. That was it. To be honest, when I took this job, I thought, I'll hit a couple of singles, maybe a double, and then I'll get a bigger, better job somewhere else." Soon after that, Higgins and his team got their first big commitment with the $600 million steel plant from Severcor, later called Severstal. Then they began applications for a second megasite, which also succeeded. The TVA has certified only 8 altogether, including the 2 in Columbus. Then they proceeded on through the list of other successful industrial recruitments, which in all have brought in billions of new investment and something like 5,600 new jobs to an area where the unemployment rate, even with this new work, is still around 15%. The latest big investment news for the region was from Yokohama Tire, which, when we visited, was building a $300 million new plant near West Point, the most depressed part of the Golden Triangle area. It was to employ 500 people when it opened the following year, toward a planned total of 2,000. As part of the courtship process, Higgins's group arranged a site visit by the Yokohama Corporate High Command. Helicopter tours of the area, green tea and hot moist towels to refresh the visitors at each stop, galoshes to protect their shoes from the black prairie mud after a rainstorm. During the aerial tour, Higgins took Yokohama's chairman over the ruins of what had been, for nearly a century, the economic foundation of West Point. This was the meatpacking plant, locally owned for decades by the Bryan family and then taken over by the firm that eventually closed it, Sara Lee. "I told the chairman of Yokohama that this was an area that placed a lot of stress on long-term relationships," Higgins told me. "People worked for Bryan for generations. When that plant left, it tore the heart out of the whole community. I said, 'You can be the phoenix rising up for the next generations.'" Hokey, yes. But Higgins said that the helicopter then did several circles around the plant while the chairman stared down at the devastation. "He looked over at me and nodded," Higgins said. "I told the pilot, 'We can go now.'" What has it cost and what has it brought? During our visits to town, we talked with newspaper reporters, black and white civic and labor leaders, people who had been laid off, and people who had found new jobs. Most of what we heard was positive. The area had been heading down, and now it was looking up. But for any aspect of the modern American economy, the next question, the real question, is this. Who was being helped and hurt? Who was getting new opportunities? Who was being left behind? Everything about Mississippi is, of course, shaped by the history of race. That is true for the United States in general, and perhaps most of all in this state. But by all measures we could observe, the industrial boom was offering more to poor people of all races than they had expected a decade earlier. The biggest industrial employers, Severstal and PACCAR, told us that the racial balance of their employees is representative of the region. On the visits I made, 3 to the steel mill, 2 to the engine factory, the workforce appeared slightly more white than black, like the population of the region as a whole, which is about 50% white and 40% black, with Asians, Latinos, and others making up the rest. Certainly it was closer to being racially diverse in the fashion of a military unit than being overwhelmingly white in the fashion of many corporations or especially high-tech firms. The average earnings for hourly employees at Severstal at the time, according to Joe Max Higgins, was around $80,000 before benefits, or more than twice the median household income in the area. At PACCAR, it was less, but still well above the median household income in the area. Some of the line employees I spoke with, black and white, had come back to the area after holding jobs elsewhere. One I met had previously worked at Sara Lee and then come to the steel mill. Several others had always lived in the vicinity. I'm not even interested in factories that aren't going to pay a lot more than people are already making here, Joe Max Higgins told me. Why would I be? If you're going to create jobs at that level, you're forever dooming your area. He mentioned a conversation he'd had with the mayor of a small town in Tennessee. I'll never forget when he told me, "I can't wait for the Blue Jeans plant to close in town." You never hear a politician say that. He said, "We gotta get those ladies to community college and get their skills up. I can't run my town on minimum wage." I thought that was the deepest thing I ever heard.
One day in Columbus, we toured the distressed facilities of a factory that had made toilet seats and the abandoned pants factory. Before winding up at the bricked-up marble headstone factory, one of our hosts mentioned that we would pass near the orphanage. "Orphanage, that is so sad," I blurted out, envisioning something Dickensian or out of The Dark Side of Harper Lee. "Actually, the children live very well," rebutted our host gently. I set out the next day to visit the orphanage, which everyone I met in Columbus called the Palmer Home. The Palmer Home for Children, first known as the Palmer Orphanage, was started in 1895 by the First Presbyterian Church of Columbus with help from all the other churches in town. It still retains its strong Christian heritage. Like any institution that has endured for more than a century, the Palmer Home has felt the effects of wars and economic ups and downs, as well as, in its particular purview, a shift away from the public embrace of classic orphanages, the wane and wax of government engagement with child welfare issues, and major shifts in the demographics of the American family. There was also a fire. One big change that affected the everyday and overall lives of the children came in the 1960s, when the Palmer Home began moving its children out of big traditional dorm-like buildings, which today are mostly used for administration and communal cooking and dining, to on-campus individual homes. This idea, which was new to the times, and especially new in the South, was a move toward more family-style living. The cottages, as the houses were quaintly called, were designed for 6 to 8 children to live with a set of house parents, the overall effect resembling a much more normal family life. Our guide around the Palmer Home told me a particularly poignant story about the background of one of the early cottages. In 1967, there was a catastrophic mid-air collision between a Piedmont Airlines Boeing 727 and a twin-engine Cessna over Hendersonville, North Carolina. Everyone aboard the two planes was killed, 82 people in all, including 3 from Columbus, J. Dudley Hutchinson, the owner of a wholesale food company, his son of the same name, and a new employee, C. L. Hutcherson. They did not leave orphans, but they did, in effect, leave a gift to the orphanage, which came in the form of a memorial fund from the people of Columbus. Today, that is Hutchinson House, one of the first of the seven cottages there now. The cottages, long one-story ranch-style buildings, are set around the main lawns with a playground, basketball court, and lots of running space. Horses and stables are off to one side, a baseball diamond and a swimming pool off to another. There's also a gym. When I visited, some boys were playing basketball and one girl was skipping across the lawn and another was trotting by on a horse. The campus sprawls over 110 acres, amounting to a small farm with vegetable gardens, orchards, and 12 big greenhouses, which were abloom with all sorts of flowers, including my favorite Gerber daisies. The farming is a source of revenue for the Palmer home, from the produce they sell at the local farmers market to their new venture, a community-supported agriculture program, CSA, where people buy a season subscription for fresh produce. It is also a way for the children to learn farming skills and to earn pocket money by working on the farm. Most of the children fan out to public and private schools around town, whichever seems to be the best match. A few are homeschooled at the Palmer home. There's an abundance of outside opportunities and support. Camping and fishing trips, trips to Disney parks, service trips, tutors, therapists. The cottages reminded me of houses of some childhood friends who came from big Catholic families of 7, 10, or even a dozen kids. Everything in those homes seemed industrial-sized to me, organized to ladle out life and love in well-managed, huge portions. The living space in the Palmer home cottages was similarly expansive and stretched out along a long hallway with double bedrooms, decorated as individually as new college freshman dorm rooms, and bathrooms connecting pairs of bedrooms. The laundry room had double sets of washers and dryers. In this house, the kids who were old enough to manage each had a day to wash her own clothes. I saw some of the seven girls living in the house I visited, along with their small but very strong-looking house mom, who had a new baby of her own. House parents in each cottage live 3 weeks on and 1 week off. Often, R&R is taken in the small separate cottage on campus. Sibling orphans often live together in the same cottage. Which brings us to terminology. Orphan, double orphan, social orphan, children waiting, foster child, foster care, orphanage, group home, house parents, caregivers, residential care, out-of-home care. Which words to choose? The nuances of meaning have shifted with the social contexts of the times. Yesterday's orphan is not today's orphan. An orphan, technically, has no living biological parents. A double orphan is another way of saying this. Social orphans may have a biological parent, but that parent is not able to care for them. Foster children are in the legal care of someone besides a biological parent. A child waiting is legally able to be adopted, and on and on. Drake Bassett, who came recently from a completely different corporate world to be the president and CEO of the Palmer home, described his puzzlement early on at how he should refer to the children at Palmer home. "Are they orphans or not?" he asked a colleague. They talked over the many possible terms and finally decided, "They are children. Let's call them children." This felt right and freed them to attach whatever descriptive phrases they needed to suit the situation. So who believes in this Mississippi orphanage? Plenty of people, as it turns out. The home is privately funded, beginning with the smallest checks or proceeds from its farm and thrift shops, and growing to more substantial support from many churches, private donations, foundations, estates, and from industry giants, including Monsanto, Chick-fil-A, and the nearby Severstal steel plant, which donated a computer lab for the home, as well as the founder of Gary's Pawn and Gun Shop, who dedicated funds to the Palmer home in honor of his daughter Ginger, who passed away. The orphanage was another surprising example to me, like MSMS, of where Mississippi excels.
The factories brought work to this part of Mississippi. But solving one problem opened up several more. When you create thousands of high-wage, high-skill jobs in an area with very low median income, poorly ranked schools, and a history of farming and low-end factories rather than advanced manufacturing, you raise another question. Where are companies going to find the right people to do these jobs? Sure, lots of people need work, but the ones who have been laid off from packing houses or cut-and-sew minimum-wage garment plants, or who have not held a steady job at all, may not be ready to help run a billion-dollar modern steel mill or an Airbus helicopter factory. This is where East Mississippi Community College, or EMCC, comes in. What we had seen in Camden County, a revolution in career technical training with significant social and economic effects, was underway here. Back at the dawn of time, when I was in high school, vocational ed had a patronizing loser tone. The modern career technical programs that we were beginning to see across the country, in contrast, aspire to help people avoid the minimum wage service or retail trap with better paid jobs as skilled repair technicians, in healthcare, in construction and design, in advanced modern factories, in law enforcement, and in other living wage categories. Many of these schools naturally operate on a dispersed public good principle. They have no way of knowing where the students they're training will end up working 10 or 20 years from now. So they proceed on the belief that the area will always need more welders and more nurses, and it will be better for the region to have a larger pool of better skilled workers. Also, it increases the prospects that some large corporation might open a branch there, and new startup businesses might arise. And it's obviously a plus for the students to have more skills and options, whether they stay nearby or leave. EMCC's current ambitions are more targeted. The good jobs are coming to its Golden Triangle region, thanks to the efforts of its promoters. The big new factories have already brought in thousands of higher-skill, higher-wage jobs. An enormous plant from Yokohama Tire will bring more. The challenge is to prepare local people to qualify for them. This is the challenge Raj Shaunak has undertaken. Raj's family is Indian. He was born in Kenya, and as a teenager, he moved with his family to England, where he went to college. I will refer to him as Raj because that is how everyone seems to know him locally. When he picks up the phone, he says slowly and in a deep voice, "Raj," or "This is Raj." His accent is an arresting combination of UK Indian and Mississippi Southern. In 1972, Raj paid a visit to Mississippi to see his brother, who was then at Mississippi State University in Starkville. He ended up staying and building a very successful manufacturing business with other family members. In 1989, the family sold the business, and Raj was freed from workaday economic concerns. On October 31st of that year, he dramatically threw his wristwatch into the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway outside Columbus and began the next stage of his life. Me: "Raj, could I call you at 11 a.m. tomorrow?" Raj: "Jim, I have no watch. Call me when you would like." 2 years later, he was teaching adult education courses and math. By 1994, he had begun what is now his major commitment: workforce development, or preparing people in the community for the jobs that the Economic Development Commission is trying to attract. The results can be seen in various ways around this part of the state. EMCC has brochures, billboards, ads, and other publicity all over town, letting people know about its programs. Students who enroll go through what Raj calls skills-based pathways, which essentially assess the skills and disciplines they do and don't have, and train them accordingly. In the EMCC training facilities, students work on real versions, or sometimes scaled-down models, of the machinery and products being made in the local factories. I saw them dealing with real engines from the nearby PACCAR factory and real computer-controlled machine tools. What happens to the ones who don't get hired? Raj asked me, anticipating the question, after he had shown me through a mock assembly line where workers were trained. They'll have much higher skills, and they will be more marketable, either when Yokohama opens its next phase, another 500 jobs, or anywhere else. He explained further, "We cannot guarantee a job for anyone. We are in the business of training people to be part of a qualified pool of applicants. We're trying to move people from dependence to enterprise and independence." There may be an underside to EMCC and the programs it is carrying out. I didn't pretend to be launching a detailed investigation. But at face value, the people I asked, students at the school, without Raj or other officials present, alumni in the factories, some one-third of whom had been through EMCC, people around town, all described it as a plus. Just before our visit, the state's lieutenant governor had come to town to praise Raj and others at EMCC for what they had achieved. Mississippi has the highest proportion of African Americans of all states at around 38%. All the classrooms, cafeterias, libraries, and factory sites I saw were racially mixed, if not exactly in the 50-40 white-black ratio for the Golden Triangle region, then with a much larger black presence than mere tokenism. Raj, by the way, seemed to enjoy and make the most of his other status on the black-white racial grid. He works very closely with Joe Max Higgins. I heard him on a call with Higgins, who was in a rush, as always, and had to hang up. Joe, you never have time for the brown man, Raj said, obviously using a familiar joke line between the two. On our third visit to town, Raj took me to a catfish buffet at Lion Hills, a former private and formerly segregated country club that has now become an EMCC dining center and golf course, as well as a training facility for its restaurant management, chef training, and turf management programs. He worked his way through the racially mixed group of diners and students there, seeming to slightly code-switch his accent from group to group. In most big cities where I have lived, "How are you?" is a pro forma question to which no one expects a real answer. In this part of Mississippi, people treated it as an actual query, deserving an extended reply. Thus, Raj moved around the room, shaking hands, patting people on the back, taking time to exchange words with everyone dining and working there. Does any of this matter? The industrial recruitment efforts and the training of a workforce? People in the state think it does. Tate Reeves, the lieutenant governor, said at a local event, "The industrial boom in the Golden Triangle happened because leaders in the Golden Triangle made it possible." Raj told me on the phone, "When you are competing for businesses, you have to have the infrastructure, you have to have the quality of life, you have to have the land. But most places that are competing have those things. We now have a critical mass of trained and trainable workers. Companies have told us that this makes the difference." The southern cities we'd visited in the first half of 2014 had all undergone some sort of deep economic shock. For Greenville and the surrounding communities of the upstate, it had been the rapid loss of the textile companies that even in the early 1990s had been major employers. For St. Mary's and its environs in the coastal Georgia pinelands, it was the sudden disappearance of the region's dominant industry, followed, fortunately and thanks mainly to Georgia's political pull, by the arrival of the U.S. Navy. For northeastern Mississippi, the departure of low-wage workshops like the toilet seat factory and blue jeans plant compounded economic and social problems that were decades, even centuries in the making. But each of these areas, like others we'd visited, was experimenting to find ways ahead. Starting that summer, we headed north, toward areas that in their prime had been the symbolic and at times the real hearts of American manufacturing greatness. These were places that contemporary Americans think of as the Rust Belt, and that boosters would like to rebrand as the Chrome Belt. They include cities like such one-time world leaders in steelmaking as Pittsburgh, at the western end of Pennsylvania, and Allentown and Bethlehem in the east. We went as well to Charleston and its surroundings in West Virginia, where during FDR's era, most families in the state drew their incomes directly or indirectly from coal mining. We went to Duluth, Minnesota, which grew rich in the late 19th century as the westernmost Great Lakes terminus for the grain, the timber, the iron ore, and the other bounty coming from the American plains and prairie to customers on the East Coast and beyond. Some of the Gilded Age novels by Theodore Dreiser, like The Financier and The Titan, use Duluth as a shorthand for the opportunities and social upheaval that new technologies and global markets had brought in the late 1800s, much as Detroit symbolized in the early 1900s and California at mid-century. We went to Columbus, Ohio, whose immediate economy had long been based on state government as Ohio's capital city and by all the activity generated by the Ohio State University. But Columbus has been tied as well to the ups and downs of Ohio's manufacturing economy and its still surprisingly important farming sector. Head a few miles in any direction outside the city, and you're in farmland. Overall, agriculture makes up more than a tenth of the entire Ohio economy. What we found in most of these places was a certain kind of public and civic life that was consistent with what we'd seen across the country over the preceding year, and at odds with what politics had come to mean in national coverage. Public decisions in these towns didn't always turn out right. They weren't always fair in their effects and benefits. They weren't always free of special interest distortions. But compared with the big showdowns in national politics of the past few presidencies, or even most policymaking at the state level, what these cities had done to prepare for long-term challenges, to take advantage of new opportunities, and to minimize posturing and polarization was impressive. The stories of their mayors and other civic leaders obviously oversimplify the reasons for their success, but they struck us as useful shorthands for why these cities had done the things they had. Caddo Lake, Louisiana, Texas. We usually began our city visits talking about dollars and cents topics, how the economy was doing, whether businesses were moving into downtown or away from it, how the schools were funded and how well they were preparing students for opportunities in the area or beyond. But time and again, we found that the same forces of local patriotism that motivated young people to start their families or businesses in a smaller town, or that convinced mature people to stay there and assume civic responsibilities, also showed up strongly in non-commercial realms. These ranged from promoting the arts to supporting local sports and recreation to protecting the environment. Our stop in the remote area of Caddo Lake, which straddles the border between Texas and Louisiana, illustrated the latter point. It was an unusual conjunction of a prominent personality with local loyalties and a long-term effort to make a difference in the environment. Caddo is the largest natural lake in the South and one of the very few natural lakes of any size in the state of Texas. There, most bodies of water, like Lake Travis near Austin or Lake Conroe near Houston, are the result of dam-building projects from the late 1800s onward. Caddo now has a weir at the far eastern end of the lake, but it was formed by two natural, if unusual-sounding, phenomena. One was the effect of the Great Raft, starting about 1,000 years ago. This term refers to an enormous, wholly natural pileup of tree trunks, branches, and other debris in the shallow twists and oxbows of the local Red and Atchafalaya rivers. At its greatest extent, the logjam stretched for more than 100 miles, and it blocked the river's flow sufficiently to create an impounded lake behind it. The other was a series of major earthquakes in the early 1800s, originating from the new Madrid Fault Line in the Mississippi River Valley north of Memphis and near the Boot Hill of Missouri. Those quakes, including four that were each as strong as nearly any that have struck California or Alaska, occurred from the fall of 1811 through the spring of 1812. They are thought to have lowered the ground level in the Caddo area enough to create the current natural lake basin. U.S. government observers from the James Madison administration were not in the region to record the effects in Caddo, but the earthquakes play a major role in the histories of the Caddo Nation, a confederation of tribes who lived throughout the Southeast. They were taken as an omen of troubled days ahead for the Caddo, which of course arrived in the form of Andrew Jackson, and the era of anti-Indian warfare and extirpation. By the 1830s, the Caddo had sold their lake area land to the U.S. government under President Jackson for a token sum and were moved west. They are still recognized as a nation with official headquarters in Oklahoma. The two centuries after the earthquake were times of trouble for the lake itself. In the early 1800s, white explorers speculated about removing the Great Raft to allow waterborne commerce from the ports of the Gulf Coast into the Mississippi Valley. Through the 1830s, an engineering-minded riverboat captain named Henry Miller Shreve supervised a program of blasting, hauling away, and otherwise removing the logs that made up the Great Raft. The work was completed after the Civil War, lowering the lake level by some 10 feet, taking commerce away from several inland ports that had grown up along the Caddo, including a town called Jefferson that had become the second largest city in Texas at the time, and transferring it to a major downriver settlement now known as Shreveport, in Shreve's honor. In the early 1900s, the oil discovery boom in Texas and Louisiana spread to the Caddo area. What is thought to be the first ever offshore rig was built in Caddo Lake in 1911 by the predecessor to Gulf Oil. Modest level oil production has continued ever since. One of the settlements on the Louisiana side of the lake is called Oil City. During World War II, the military established its Longhorn Army Ammunition Plant at Caddo, manufacturing bombs and rocket fuel and heavily polluting the lake itself. After the munitions plant finally closed in the 1990s, local developers attempted to transfer its water use rights to new heavy industries they wanted to attract to the area. In short, this 25-mile-long body of water in the swampy South has been through the sort of battering usually associated with Lake Erie in its most troubled pre-Clean Water Act era. Its human and industrial history means that Caddo Lake is anything but pristine. But by the time of our visit, after a flight west from the Golden Triangle of Mississippi over Caddo Lake to the nearest airport in Marshall, Texas, the lake looked pristine. More, it looked and felt serene, set apart, timeless, undisturbed. We later learned that the appearance was misleading in one important way. A site that had endured the dirtiest of modern industrial activities, drilling, blasting, poisoning, had become the object of ecotourism from around the world, and one of only two dozen marsh or wetland areas in the United States to win international designation under the Ramsar Convention as a wetland of international importance. How had this happened? Why here? The answer, improbably, involves the rock musician Don Henley, who grew up in the nearby East Texas town of Linden, who spent summers of his childhood in the 1950s fishing on the lake with his father, and who now says it is the most beautiful place I know on earth. By the mid-1970s, Henley had left Texas for Los Angeles and had become famous as drummer, singer, and songwriter for the Eagles. But amid the other distractions and activities of his career, Henley decided relatively early to direct some of his name brand influence and rock star wealth towards environmental causes. In the late 1980s, he was part of a bitter battle against the Boston-based real estate developer Mortimer Zuckerman, by coincidence then also the owner of the Atlantic magazine, over Zuckerman's plan to turn a parcel of land near Walden Pond into a commercial complex, This was the Walden Pond of Henry Thoreau fame, which Thoreau had described in early issues of The Atlantic, among other venues. Henley and an alliance of conservationists went against Zuckerman, celebrity against celebrity, and eventually the conservationists won. Henley organized and helped fund the Walden Woods Project, which bought the contested property and put it into permanent protected status. The Walden Institute operates by the pond, and Henley still visits frequently and raises funds for it. Because of Walden's location just outside Boston and its international renown, that conservation project drew much more media attention than the parallel effort Henley was launching at about the same time to restore Caddo Lake from the damage done by decades of oil drilling and munitions work, and to protect it from future threats of pollution and overdevelopment. In the early 1990s, along with a Colorado-based attorney and environmental activist named Dwight Shellman, Henley founded and largely funded the Caddo Lake Institute. It bought and preserved land, sponsored research projects, and blocked proposed construction of a commercial barge channel through the lake as part of the effort that won Caddo its protected status under the Ramsar Convention. It worked with other nonprofits and with government agencies, from the Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to nearby city councils, toward its goal of protecting the ecological, cultural, and economic integrity of Caddo Lake. Henley hit back at accusations that he was an outside agitator celebrity by pointing out that he'd grown up just miles away and still took his children to stay in a double-wide trailer he owns by the lake, in addition to a house. A quarter century after the Caddo Lake Institute's founding, Henley is still chair of its board and does fundraisers and promotional interviews and videos for it. We had learned about Caddo and Henley's involvement through a further string of improbabilities. While living in China, I wrote an Atlantic article about the country's tragic dilemma involving coal. China couldn't stop using coal if it hoped to sustain its all-out pace of industrialization. But it couldn't keep using coal if it hoped to protect its people against currently toxic air or reduce carbon emissions. The way out of the dilemma, I argued, was for Chinese and U.S. technologists to work together on clean energy and cleaner coal innovations. Henley read the article and sent me an unexpected email suggesting that we meet during the Eagles' upcoming concert tour in China. On a bitterly cold night in early 2011, Deb and I went from our apartment on the east side of Beijing to what had been the 2008 Olympic volleyball stadium on the west side to join an ecstatic and sold-out crowd of Chinese fans of all generations, on their feet singing along with Desperado and Hotel California. The Eagles had been among the first Western rock groups to win popular favor in China, and this was their first appearance on Chinese soil in years. The next day, we went with Henley to a coal company's environmental research center an hour outside Beijing. We stayed in touch with Henley on environmental matters and heard from him about Caddo. We flew to Marshall on our trip west, rented a car, and drove to the settlement of Uncertain, Texas, on the west shore of Caddo Lake. Henley was preparing to embark on a European tour just then, so his longtime friend and environmentalist ally Rick Michaels showed us around. Why is the little town named Uncertain? No one seems to know for sure. It apparently started as a bureaucratic mistake and has lasted as a novelty. From 3 feet above water level, our perspective on the pontoon boat in which Rick Michaels toured us around the lake, at first glance, Caddo looked like a slightly less Spanish moss-laden version of the Okefenokee Swamp of Georgia. But the farther we ventured into its bayous and across its silent stretches, the more it seemed distinct from any place we'd ever seen before. Stumps and living trunks of bald cypress rose from the dark water. The name bald cypress makes the trees sound inelegant, but as they taper up from their broad bases, the trunks have the straight, austere beauty of Western redwoods, and something like their scale and age. Nearly all the bald cypresses in North America grow along the southern Atlantic and Gulf coasts. the tallest rise more than 120 feet above water level. The oldest known specimen in North Carolina is at least 1,600 years old. According to Michaels, some of the trees around us in Caddo were more than 400 years old. The more ancient the tree, the more it was surrounded by several-foot-tall, thin stumps called cypress knees. Turtles slid off rocks or tree trunks into the water as we drew near. Egrets flapped overhead. Herons prowled through the marshes and stabbed for frogs.